You are listening to The Realish Report. Here's your host, John Friend.
All right, folks, welcome back to another edition of The Realish Report. This is your host, John Friend. Joining me today is Mike King of the informative website TomatoBubble.com. Mike recently published a new book entitled The British Mad Dog, Debunking the Myth of Winston Churchill, a book we will be focusing on during this first introductory segment. Mike, welcome to the program, sir. How are you today?
Hey, I'm doing well. Great to be back with you, John. Very excited to talk about this game-changing book here.
Yeah, me too, man. You've been a guest on the program numerous times in the past, and you really are one of my favorite people to interview because we see eye to eye on so many subjects, it seems like. And, you know, you've really done a lot of good work over the years. And, you know, most people who are listening, I'm sure, are familiar with your work at this point. As I mentioned, your website is tomatobubble.com, and I subscribe via email to get all your updates and you know, see all your latest pieces, your latest articles. And I know Rents.com features a lot of your work as well. But I guess just to get this conversation started, can you briefly highlight your website and some of its features and maybe also tell us how people can support your work?
Yes. Well, TomatoBubble.com, the whole mission of the website is to take seemingly complex but very important issues regarding history, economics, philosophy, current events and news, and boil them down to very simple, easy-to-digest articles, which are very heavy on illustration. And I don't bore the reader with a ton of unnecessary verbiage. Everything is really clear, concise, to the point. And, you know, I do this for a reason. I feel there's a great demand out there to get good, solid information, but to get it quickly and to come up the learning curve really fast. So what TomatoBubble.com strives to do is to achieve a balance between simplicity but without being simplistic in its analysis. So it's just the type of website, everything on it, every piece, every book, every article is geared to taking even someone who's totally uninformed and bringing them up to speed and fast. That's what's so unique about TomatoBubble.com. So, have a look at it. People could sign up for my free report, which is how to respond to an anti-conspiracy theorist, and it'll also get free updates. In fact, I would say 90% of everything I've ever published is free at the site. And then there's some PDF books, which are also available at Amazon that people can purchase. That's how I support myself. And also donations are appreciated. I don't sell advertising. But that's how people can help. But whether they want to help or whether they want to buy my books or not, there's still a ton of free stuff that will really rock your mind.
Absolutely, yeah. Now, a lot of your books, or I guess all of your books, are all available from Amazon.com, is that correct?
Yes, they are all available, and these are typically anywhere between 120 pages to 250 pages. The Planet Rothschild two-volume set is 300 pages each. They're all available at Amazon as paperback. My Amazon author page is MS King. You can also see the books described at tomatobubble.com. They all come in Kindle format as well. And I also have PDF options that people can purchase through the site. So there's many different ways to obtain the books.
Right. Okay, very good. Yeah, and I'd encourage everybody to definitely check out your site, you know, subscribe to the updates because you do a lot of really good work. You're putting out a lot of great content. And all of your books are certainly worth purchasing and reading. I mean, they really do give you a very good understanding of a lot of these, you know, very complex topics. And much of our history, and we'll get into this as we proceed here with this conversation, much of our history has been entirely distorted, in some cases totally fabricated, and, you know, truly weaponized against, I think really at this point it's weaponized against the entire world, but specifically the white race. And, you know, this is a topic we've talked about in the past, and you know, we will obviously talk about this again today. So let's jump right into your latest book, which again is titled The British Mad Dog, Debunking the Myth of Winston Churchill. And, you know, to be honest, I really didn't know a whole lot about Winston Churchill prior to reading your book. I certainly his background. I mean, I understood his role during World War I and World War II as, you know, the central, you know, a leading figure over in Britain. But I didn't really know anything about his background. And, you know, since I've been, you know, really sort of reinvestigating and almost relearning history, and recognizing that we have been deceived and lied to about so many events and so many figures, it's, you know, I've really came to the conclusion that anybody that is, you know, sort of put on a pedestal and presented to us as this great figure, they really are, in fact, the most despicable and traitorous, quote unquote, leaders and figures. So, you know, it's almost as if the Jewish dominated historical establishment and, you know, all these cultural Marxists and outright communists, they really do lionize the most despicable and traitorous leaders while demonizing and trashing, you know, our greatest heroes, you know, the people that really were, yes, we could consider heroes.
Yes, I mean, that's exactly correct. And it is a rule that I live by. It's, I would say, 99% accurate. If you take anyone who's being puffed up, whether it's a current personage or someone from history, you can pretty much assure anyone who's been puffed up over the last 100 years, even 150 years, you know he is a, like you said, despicable, low-down criminal serving the powers that be. And then conversely, anyone who is vilified, you pretty much automatically know they're either not as bad as people say, and in many cases, they're actually heroic figures. So the world really is upside down. And you know, that might sound shocking to people, but, you know, consider we live in a world now where a boy can be a girl and a girl can be a boy. So you know, you start thinking along those lines, and it becomes more and more plausible to think of the arch villain of all time being Adolf Hitler has actually been the most heroic figure of the 20th century. And then conversely, people like FDR and Churchill being monsters. And that's really the way it goes. I mean, sure, your audience knows this already, but for people coming across this for the first time, it's a shock to them.
It really is, yeah. And you're absolutely right. I mean, think about, you know, from an American perspective, think about the most lionized figures, you know, in our history. Who comes to mind? As you mentioned, FDR, Martin Luther King.
Marxist loser king.
Right, yeah. I mean, some of these people are just so despicable. And yeah. I mean, if you look at it from an, you know, sort of an international level, who else comes to mind? Nelson Mandela, Churchill.
Oh.
Yeah, and then if you look at the most demonized figures, Hitler, you know, I mean, we could go on and talk all about this, but
Joe McCarthy.
Yeah. Right. McCarthy.
One of my heroes. Yeah.
Lindbergh, for example. Yeah. So really, I mean, the world is absolutely upside down. I mean, and again, you know, people that are not familiar with this information or maybe haven't thought too much about these subjects, it is sort of difficult to come to grips with that. But I think if you really are objective and you really are looking for the truth, this is the only conclusion you can come to.
Yeah, that's right. It's actually, I have quite a few articles at my site that deal in philosophy. And it's not because I'm going off on a tangent, because you really need to be grounded in sound logic and philosophy, Greek philosophy, to be able to appreciate the depths of the con. Because what philosophy teaches you is that, yes, it is indeed possible, and it's actually pretty much been the case historically that the ruling classes of every civilization that ever existed has used, either for better or for worse, some degree of mythology to rule over the masses. So that's standard operating procedure, the use of mythology. Sometimes it's religious mythology, and I'm a firm believer in God, don't get me wrong, but you know, sometimes religious mythologies are used to control people for good, and sometimes to do bad things. There's political mythologies, but that's standard history right there. So it's not unusual to there's no reason to believe, just because we live in the modern age, that somehow we're immune to this. We're being conned by the elites. That's
exactly.
Yeah.
It's true, yeah. And I mean, I think, you know, this really is a communist strategy to tear down our great leaders and our great heroes and to really weaponize history against us. This has been a communist strategy going back to, you know, the 19th century.
Oh, yeah.
So this is really nothing new.
No, yeah. And it's accelerating. It's getting really bad. I mean,
they're taking down. They want to take down Andrew Jackson from the $20
bill. I was just going to say that.
Yeah, yeah.
The greatest president in American history, the man who paid off the national debt to zero, killed the central bank, and now the most commonly circulated bill in America is going to be plastered with Aunt Jemima. You got to be kidding me.
It's a disgrace. Yeah.
And you know, when I first heard this, I said, you know what, I'm no fan of Alexander Hamilton, but I'm going to start using $10 bills when this comes out. But lo and behold, the back of the $10 bills, they're putting a bunch of communists and radical Negroes. I think there's going to be a collage on the back of the 10. Rosa Parks, some opera singer, Marian Anderson, the communist lesbian Eleanor Roosevelt, and I think they're also going to debase the back of the $5 bill. So, Abby, what are we going to do now? Just use singles, I guess. But I don't even want these things in my wallet. It's such a spit in our face. It's like, F you, white man.
That is exactly what it is.
Yes.
That there's no doubt. That's exactly what it is. And it's just going to increase until we finally stand up and stop being afraid of being called racist or, yeah, you know, an anti-Semite or whatever. You know, people got to, you know, grow a spine here and, you know, stop being deceived and stop being pushed around by these people.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, I learned that lesson on the streets of New Jersey growing up, that, you know, you let someone push you around, it's just going to get worse. So you bop them in the nose and then they'll go away.
Right. It's true. Well, I want to jump into your book and you kind of go through Churchill's background sort of in a chronological order. And I want to start with his family background. And I guess, as I mentioned, I didn't really know a whole lot about him, at least his family background and his roots. But he seems to really come from a sort of, establishment type family over in England.
Yes, it goes back 250 years. That's a quarter of a millennium of blue blood family. Well, I mean, they weren't aristocratic. They didn't have royal blood, but they were very prominent politically for 250 years. So it begins in the 1600s with Sir John Churchill. That's one of his great ancestors. So by the time Winston Churchill is born a couple centuries later, you're talking multi-generational privilege and wealth. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing, but what you find often with these type of characters is, at some point they just lose all touch with reality and any connection with the common man. It can be very dangerous, but that's what he comes from, 250 years of elite privilege.
Right, exactly, yeah. Now, another thing I didn't know about was his family connections to the American elite and to Wall Street. And this comes on his mother's side, is that correct?
Yes, his mother was Jenny Jerome. She was an American socialite. She was the daughter of Leonard Jerome, who at the time, this would be mid to late 1800s, was referred to as the King of Wall Street. He worked on some projects with August Belmont, who was a Rothschild representative. His real name was Shoneman. He came to America. He changed it to Belmont. He became the head of the Democratic Party. So there's a linkage there to the House of Rothschild. So there's, you know, immense wealth and privilege on the mother's side as well.
Right, exactly. And another thing about his mother is she seems to be, she was quite promiscuous.
Oh my God. Let me tell you, even by today's standards, okay, we live in the modern day Sodom and Gomorrah degeneracy, but even by today's standards, she would be considered a total skank and a whore. It was just incredible. The amount of men that she slept with, they were mostly all princes. At the time, American socialite women, you know, everybody wanted to marry a prince or a duke or something in Europe. They spent a lot of time in Europe because, her parents had problems, marital problems. The King of Wall Street liked to run around. He had lady friends. So there was a period of time where the mother would just take the daughters and would live in Europe for a long time. But she started sleeping around. I mean, in my book, I named like six or seven of her known lovers. But there's really no telling how many she slept with. She was highly promiscuous. And indeed, she became pregnant with Winston out of wedlock. Okay. Winston, they say, was born, quote unquote, prematurely, but he was born 8 months after the wedding between Lord Randolph Churchill, who was one of the heads of the British Parliament, and Jenny Jerome. So he was conceived out of wedlock. He was probably not the father.
Yeah, so, that's what I was going to say. It seemed, your book seemed to imply that, but there's not necessarily any proof of that.
Well, what there is proof of, and this comes from a Serbian researcher who did a book on the former king of Yugoslavia. He was a prince when he was sleeping with Jenny Jerome. But what she clearly establishes is that they had a lengthy, hot and heavy relationship at exactly the time that Winston was conceived. So there's no doubt about that. Once she goes back, she plows through original documents and letters. So he was definitely one of the princes that she was sleeping with. So based on the research of her diaries and Jenny Jerome's diaries and writings, she believes that Winston was actually the son of Prince Milan. And indeed, if you look at the pictures of Prince Milan, John Churchill, or Lord Randolph Churchill, and Winston Churchill, all of them taken in their 30s, there's much more of a facial resemblance to the prince than there is to John Churchill. And it's interesting, this book was not translated into English. I cannot find an English version of it. I found some translations of excerpts that were published in the Daily Mail, but it seems in the West that they don't want to visit this subject. There's also evidence of Churchill destroying parts of his mother's diary, ripping out pages. So it seems that he was aware of this and he's trying to cover this up. So,
right.
So not only she's sleeping around and conceives Winston with another man, she evidently makes a real cuckold out of Lord Randolph Churchill, and he ends up marrying her, evidently believing that he's the father. Then there's the second son that was born was Jack Churchill, and from Jenny Jerome's own sisters later on, they say Jack is not the son either of Lord Randolph Churchill. He was actually sired by another prince. I mean, so it's
boy,
just incredible.
What a mess.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, was this common, in these elitist circles, all this promiscuity?
Well, there's a book written, I'll get into that later, about this kind of sexual activity amongst the British elite during that time. And it actually began to become quite common. And it makes perfect sense. There's an old proverb, a Greek proverb, that says the fish rots from the head first. All of the degeneracy that we've been seeing in our society really over the last 40, 50 years since the 60s and getting worse, prior to that, it existed amongst elements of the elites. It takes a while to trickle down. Now it's not even concealed. We see how the media is pushing the homosexuality and the trannies and all that. But long before that, yes, elements of the elites, you know, not all of them, but many of them started to engage in this kind of debauchery. Homosexuality was become quite common among British elite circles in the late 1800s. All this cheating on each other, children born to people they don't know who their fathers are. I mean, they really lived like a ghetto lifestyle, only they were in the elite doing it.
So exactly. And I mean, now this was really shocking to me when I was, you know, sort of first researching a lot of this information, just the extent of the sexual degeneracy, you know, in these elite circles. And we certainly see this now in a modern context. I mean, look at Bill Clinton, for example.
Right.
And you know, all of these, it's almost a requirement to get to a high level of political power to be some sort of sexual deviant, either like a closet homosexual, for example, or just, you know, totally promiscuous, or even in some cases, it's very, you know, it's very despicable to even think about, but pedophilia, a lot of these people are pedophiles.
Oh, big time, big time. And although this can't be proven, I do believe Churchill, you know, may have had a thing for the little boys as well. That he was a homosexual, there is no doubt. We can get into that later, but he was also a homosexual. I should point out that on the father's side, Lord John Randolph, Lord Randolph Churchill himself, the father, died of syphilis. It was widely believed he had all the classic indicators of syphilis.
Right. That's something you're only going to get if you are a sexual degenerate. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, these people were just out of control. And they were rotten parents, and they just raised, you know, generation after generation of just evil, corrupt, useless, untalented, unaccomplished, power-mad degenerates. And that's how we got to the point where we're at today. I mean, once your elites go rotten, it's only a matter of time before the rest of civilization goes. That's how it was in ancient Rome. I mean, Rome was at the peak of its glory and power when some of this degeneracy was taken hold amongst these reprobate emperors and elites, yet Rome was still strong. But then 100 years later, you know, it percolated down to the masses.
Right.
So that's how it goes. Yeah.
Right. Now, could you briefly highlight Churchill's education and his relationship with his parents during this time? Because he seems to be pretty alienated certainly from his father. But even from his mother as well.
Yeah, and this is some of the interesting stuff that I learned in the process of the book that I wasn't expecting to. Actually, when I undertook this project, I figured, well, this will be a piece of cake. I already know, you know, Churchill and everything he did in World War II and most of what he did in World War I. I could probably do 80% of this book just off the top of my head. Little did I know that this went so much deeper. But the evil and the insanity of the, you know, the Churchill from World War II that we know clearly stems from the child, Winston Churchill. He had a very domineering and critical father, was always putting him down, you know, felt he was a dummy, and he was a dummy. He was always at the bottom of his class. His mother, I mean, she was so self-absorbed. She was quite an attractive woman, and she knew it. And she was just full of herself. It just had no time for her children. And Churchill, as an adult, wrote about this, about how painful it was being sent away to school, elite private school, and writing letters to his mother to come visit. And she hardly ever came. Okay, she didn't care. She's out running around with her legs open all over Europe. I mean, it's incredible. But he speaks of how much he loved his mother. So he didn't have a good relationship with his father, and his mother wasn't even there to provide that affection. And it's just not good for a young boy or a young girl not to have that kind of strong bond with the mother. So he's sent away. He's picked on at school. He's bullied. He talks with a lisp. He has a slight stutter. He's the shortest kid in his class. He only grew up to be 5'6". So there's, you know, even previous mayor of London just stepped down. Boris Johnson wrote a book a couple years ago. And of course, he builds up Churchill to be a hero, but his spin is that the childhood bullying and his shortness of stature led him to be a great man, you see, because he felt he had to compensate. But in reality, what it led to was just a vicious little, inferiority complex that manifested itself throughout his career. But it's a rotten childhood. And, this is from Churchill's mouth himself. So he's away at this private school, and he goes away to a military college. Again, he's always near the bottom of his class. And it's at the school. Actually, Michael Block is a British historian, wrote a book called Closet Queens about the homosexuality, the closet homosexuals throughout British history. And he speculates that the homosexual activity began at this private school with Churchill.
Oh, wow.
It's interesting. This book that was written about the homosexuals in Britain, it's not meant to condemn them. It's not opposed to them. There's no so-called right-wing agenda or anything like that. The author is basically saying isn't it wonderful that we live in such an enlightened time today that we can now revisit this historical reality and talk openly about it? So he's not condemning Churchill in any way or any of these guys. But that was Churchill's childhood. So by the time he graduates from this military academy, again, near the bottom of his class, he's in his early 20s. He's already gone. There's nothing in him morally, intellectually. He's well on his way to being the adult degenerate that we know him as. So it was just a horrible, horrible childhood with these two nutty, self-absorbed, indeed, I would say, insane parents.
Right.
Of his.
Mm-hmm. Now, he eventually decides to become a journalist. And it's kind of interesting, how this came about. Do you think this was based on merit in his writing abilities, or more so on his connections and his desire to avoid combat?
Yeah. Well, it's the latter. I mean, Great Britain was always at war somewhere. Somewhere they were putting out a fire, whether it was Africa or Asia or, India or South Africa. And certainly, Churchill doesn't want any of that. I mean, he's a fake tough guy. He's like a Teddy Roosevelt. So rather, he graduates from the military college, but rather than taking a position where he could potentially be exposed to combat or danger, he signs up as an embedded journalist, a military journalist. And through the influence of – through his name, first of all, this is the great name, the Churchill name, the Churchill Spencer name. By the way, that's the same Spencer family that Lady Diana came from. So they're distant relatives. But his family, the combination of his family name and his mother's influence and his mother's charms, shall we say, through that, a series of very lucrative writing gigs are arranged for Winston Churchill. I mean, he's 21, 22. He's perhaps the most widely read reporter in Britain and the highest paid. And he's in Sudan, and he writes stories about the exploits. And he's always putting himself in danger, mythically, that is, in his stories. He reminds me of Geraldo Rivera. Did some time as an embedded journalist, and he was always writing about, he's getting shot at, what danger he's in. He could be killed at any time. Brian Williams was another one, but it's all embellished.
Yeah. There's many examples of these, high profile mainstream journalists embellishing stories or outright fabricating them in some cases. Didn't Hillary Clinton, what was it in like Bosnia or something? I think she made up some story.
That's right. She tells the story of she's on her way to some event in Bosnia during the war, and her daughter in a helicopter, and as they're landing, the helicopter comes under fire, and they have to take evasive maneuvers. And then the moment they landed, they had to be rushed out of there. And then pictures later emerged. You know, there's little girls giving her flower when she landed out of the helicopter. It was just all nonsense.
Yeah, these people are such phonies.
They know at their core that they're useless underachievers who've never accomplished anything, and they don't really have any talent, and they want to be great, and they have such low self-esteem that they have to invent this. You see this over and over again. Teddy Roosevelt did this. Hillary Clinton, Brian Williams, Geraldo Rivera, whether they're reporters or politicians, they're always making stuff up. You know, we've all known people like that in our own lives, you know, just right. Make things up to make. But that was Churchill. And even like pro-Churchill British historians who've studied the man have noted this pattern, that he was always describing these scenes of dangers that he was in as his reporting, which aren't true. You know, Churchill would have you believe that, you know, shrapnel is exploding all over him and he's ducking machine gunfire as he's writing in his notepad or something. It's just
exactly
crazy.
Yeah. It's interesting and you know, it's unsurprising. So, you know, one thing that I noticed, you know, just reading about his background, is that he seems to be sort of assisted and aided all throughout his career, you know, sort of like behind the scenes. And we see this, you know, we see parallels in history with Obama, for example, and even Clinton and the Bushes. It's almost as if they're being set up and they're being, you know, aided, you know, to gain positions of influence and power, you know, behind the scenes. So it's not based on their merits. It's based on this, you know, sort of hidden force.
Oh, exactly. It's the powers that be guiding them, removing obstacles from their path, protecting them, promoting them. Just like Obongo. I mean, you're exactly right. I mean, here's a guy who's a bum, a street bum, cokehead, crackhead, community. I mean, where did he come from, you know? And with Churchill, the effect was amplified by the fact that he came from such a well-known, quote-unquote, prestigious family, and then the mother's connection. So it's really, you know, he's like Obongo on steroids with those connections. And this explains why, I mean, now again, he's now at this time, he's making a fortune, the highest paid journalist in Britain, 21, 22 years old, you know, making believe he's at war. How did that come about, you know?
I'm wondering, did you read any of his books? Because, I mean, he was writing books. Obviously, he was writing all sorts of columns and reports for various newspapers. Did you read any of his books or any of his columns for this book? For your book,
yeah.
I should say?
Well,
yeah.
I've not read any of his books in totality, but I've read very lengthy excerpts of some of his books and old articles. And I tell you, I see someone who's, you know, he's adept at writing.
I was going to say he's
no Charles Dickens either, you know.
You know, I was going to say I haven't really read a whole lot of Churchill's, you know, I haven't read any of his books, but I've definitely read some of his old columns, and there's one column in particular that stands out, his Zionism versus Bolshevism,
right,
which is you know, very famous, you know, a lot of people in these circles have cited this and quoted from it, and we'll talk about that here in a few minutes. But you know, he actually was in my opinion a pretty talented writer.
No, he wrote well. I mean, listen, you came out of the British school system at that time, you know, where it was so steeped in study of Shakespeare and writing. You know, even a poor student, I mean, remember we used to say the British, they speak so well, you know. So he was an effective communicator, but probably no more or no less so than any Englishman with a basic education. And so, I mean, I'm not going to say he's a poor writer. I thought he wrote well, but the way they puff him up in history, you know, like he's Charles Dickens or something, and it's just good writing, but it's not the
right. Yeah, no, I understand.
And by the way, he also, I don't know about maybe the early years. I'm probably wrote all his stuff, but later on. Throughout his writing career, all these books that he published, he used assistants and ghostwriters. And by the time he got to the World War II memoirs, it was heavy plagiarism, and it was majority written by the ghostwriters. That's been established. So he's not as prolific of a literary figure as we've been led to believe.
Right. Well, during this period, you know, he's sort of like this embedded reporter, and he tries to portray himself as this war hero. And, right. You know, this translates directly to him gaining political office once he's back in Britain.
That's correct. What happened was, he's done a stint in the Sudan, and he was Afghanistan, India, and then he heads down to the Boer War in South Africa. And this is 1899, and he's covering events down there. And that was just a brutal war of oppression of the Boer, the descendants of the old Dutch settlers of South Africa. The Rothschilds were behind that war. They set up concentration camps for Boer women and children in that war, and as many as 25,000 died. I mean, it was really brutal what the British did down there in South Africa. And Churchill, pretty as a journalist, never touched upon this. He actually wrote about how well the British would treat the South Africans, the white South Africans, which was a lie. So that's the first thing that's noteworthy about his writing stint down at the Boer War, is that he contributed to the cover-up of the atrocities that were being committed. But the event that really gave his political career its start was when the unit that he was embedded in was captured, taken prisoner, and they were held in an old school in Pretoria. And Churchill, escapes. Mind you, he's the only one who escaped. And there's this tale of a daring escape and swimming across a raging river and then, finding the nearest British unit. And he comes home and he's a rock star. And he's like a mini rock star. This great heroic journalist found a way to escape with his life. Now, one of the nice things about, doing the website that I do and starting to pick up more readers and contacts is you never know who's going to reach out to you. I was put in communication via a third party with the man who was the grandson of someone who was at that prison that Churchill escaped. And he told me the whole story, which, I suspected all along. But I have my quote from him in the book. But essentially, the liberation of Churchill was all set up from the outside. He's important. He's got money. There might have been some kind of payoff. They opened up a hole in the fence. They let him through, and they told the guards to just kind of look the other way. And this is what happened. Churchill just walked out of that prison. In essence, his freedom was bought because right. He had a big name. It was just like John McCain. John McCain was offered his freedom too. But, of course, he couldn't accept it because then it would have looked like he was given privilege. So that's why he stayed in a Vietnam prison for another 2 years. But because McCain was the son of an admiral, the Vietnamese were willing to let him go. So, evidently the Boers who took him prisoner, because he was such a big name, they said, okay, we'll grant you this one. And there might have been some kind of payoff. But he just walked out of that prison. There's a horse waiting for him. And they cross a little stream that's 6 inches deep. So he didn't swim across some raging river. It was all a bunch of BS. But he comes back. He writes stories about it. He's a big hero. And he parlays that into a run for parliament seat, which he barely wins. But he does win.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And that was his first entry into politics, correct?
Yes.
Was when as soon as he got back.
He's still 22, 23 years old, something like that.
Yeah, and from this point in his career, I mean, really even before this, but really, when he actually gets involved in politics, we see him constantly advancing politically and, economically. And again, it's almost as if he's being sort of guided, behind the scenes. So it's not necessarily based on his merit. you know, he's one of these insiders that they're setting up, you know, for power.
Yeah, absolutely. He's being guided. This is the period of time, right about this time, slightly before, slightly after, he joins the Freemasons. So now he's really connected and protected. What else? Okay, so he wins this parliament seat, and he immediately goes on a tour, a speaking tour. And it's like a Hillary Clinton deal. He ended up being paid the equivalent of, I think it was $2 million in today's current value on this speaking tour throughout Britain, Canada, and the United States, because, you know, he's Churchill, he's a war hero. So it's just ridiculous. He writes a book of his exploits. The money is just starting to pour in now. Okay. From his speeches, his art, his writing gigs, and his books. And throughout his life, he is a money-making machine. I mean, there's probably never a year in his life where he doesn't earn the equivalent in modern dollars of multi-millions of dollars.
Right.
Okay? Yet he's always broke.
Yeah, it's really an interesting story, and you know, he was the head of the British Navy during World War One, at least at the beginning of World War One, which was a total disaster for the British. I mean, he was just totally incompetent and made all sorts of very foolish decisions.
Yeah, that's right, and you know, again, it's really incredible to read the accounts of all of his blunders and screw-ups coming from establishment British historians who still revere him as the great man. The amazing thing, John, is no matter what he does, he still remains the great man because he stood up to the big bad Hitler. But if you can shut that part of it out and just look at all the negative things that pro-Churchill establishment historians have dug up on him and put it all together, it's just he's a one-man disaster show. But yes, he's the head of the British Admiralty. Now, again, but he is appointed to this position in 1911. He's maybe 31, 32 years old, okay? And he's the head of the British Admiralty, which in Britain is sacred. I mean, that is the heart and soul of their global power was their storied navy, and he's at the head of it. How did that happen?
Exactly, yeah. How is he qualified for this again?
he comes out of a military college near the bottom of his class. He does a stint as, you know, a Geraldo Rivera type war journalist. And then here, you know, here he is now, he's head of the British Admiralty. It's just astonishing. But yes, it was World War One was a disaster, and he was one of the early in that position, which is a very important position. He was one of the key players. He's one of the leaders now of the country. So he was part of the faction that was salivating to go to war against Germany. And this attitude was by no means unanimous throughout Britain. A lot of people say, well, what is this? This war is pointless. Let's not do this. Let's slow down. I've got a quote here in the book on page 33 from the Prime Minister of Great Britain at the time that the war broke out on the continent. Prime Minister Herbert Henry Asquith. And he writes about Churchill. This is at the very beginning, just a few weeks after the assassination of the Archduke, you know, kicked off all the problems. He writes, Winston was very bellicose and demanding immediate mobilization. Winston, who has got all of his war paint on, is longing for a sea fight in the early hours of the morning to result in the sinking of the Goeben. It's a German ship. The whole thing fills me with sadness. So here's the British Prime Minister. He doesn't want to go to war yet. You know, he's not a dictator. There are forces around him pushing for war. And he confirms that, you know, the British mad dog was first and foremost among them. He would have started the war on his own anyway, Churchill. He would have started sinking German ships. That's how Naval Secretary Teddy Roosevelt, pretty much started the war with Spain on his own.
Right. Yeah, no doubt. And, you know, I want to talk more about Churchill's role during World War One and, of course, during World War Two, and we'll do that in the second segment. I want to kind of wrap up here and compare what Churchill had to say about Zionism and Bolshevism and, you know, compare it to what Adolf Hitler had to say. And we'll, I think we'll see who was actually right. And I had mentioned that article that Churchill wrote in 1920, I think. February 8th, 1920, in the Illustrated Sunday Herald. And if you just do a Google search for the Zionism versus Bolshevism, you can find it. And I'm sure you're familiar with this article.
Yeah. I have it in the Bad War, actually.
Right, okay, yeah. Yeah, and in this article, Churchill is talking about, international communism, and he describes them as international Jews and as terrorists, even. And, he talks about how Bolshevism was really this Jewish phenomenon, and it was very violent. And, well, let me just read a brief quote here. And he's spot on in this. He's spot on in his description of Bolshevism and of these international communist Jews. And he says here, "In violent opposition to all this sphere of Jewish effort rise the schemes of the international Jews. The adherents of this sinister confederacy are mostly men reared up among the unhappy populations of countries where Jews are persecuted on account of their race. Most, if not all of them, have forsaken the faith of their forefathers and divorced from their minds all spiritual hopes of the next world. This movement among the Jews is not new. From the days of Spartacus, Weishaupt, to those of Karl Marx, and down to Trotsky, Bella Kuhn, Rosa Luxemburg, and Emma Goldman, this worldwide conspiracy for the overthrow of civilization and for the reconstitution of society on the basis of arrested development, of envious malevolence, malevolence and impossible equality has been steadily growing." And he goes on and he describes the terrorist Jews, their role in Bolshevism. And then he contrasts that with Zionism. And, you know, he's basically arguing that Zionism is a righteous cause and sort of a solution to the Jewish question, right?
Right. That was the con, you see. It's like, listen, we don't want to be engulfed by, these Marxist Jews, you see. But we can save ourselves by supporting Zionism.
By supporting Zionism, exactly.
Yeah.
And that's what the British did with the Balfour Declaration and everything else.
Oh yeah, and he was hip deep in that. He actually met his wife Clementine at a big shindig thrown by one of the Rothschild ladies who had married into British royalty. But she was a big thrower of parties. I forget her name, but she was a Rothschild. So that kind of tells you something right there. You have one of the Rothschild daughters inviting Churchill to her soirees. So, he was hooked up big time with that whole Jewish gang in Britain.
Right. Well, contrast what Roosevelt had to say about Zionism. And he was spot on about Bolshevism. There's no doubt about that. But he was duped by these Zionists. And Hitler had them figured out all the way back when, he wrote Mein Kampf. And this is a quote from Mein Kampf. Hitler says, "While the Zionists try to make the rest of the world believe that the national consciousness of the Jew finds its satisfaction in the creation of a Palestinian state, or a Jewish state in Palestine, the Jews again slyly dupe the dumb goyim. It doesn't even enter their heads to build up a Jewish state in Palestine for the purpose of living there. All they want is a central organization for their international world swindler, endowed with its own sovereign rights and removed from the intervention of other states, a haven for convicted scoundrels and a university for budding crooks." And that is exactly what the state of Israel is today.
Man, and what a prophetic, heroic giant of a man he was. My conference is full of nuggets like that.
Oh my gosh, I know. Yeah, and he was so spot on, and he shows here, you know, the dumb how the Jews, you know, duped the dumb goyim, and they certainly duped guys like Churchill, and yet he's still held up as this heroic figure who is nothing but a disaster, not only for Britain but really for all of Europe,
all of the white race. Yeah,
exactly. Well, Mike, let's pick this up in the second segment. I want to talk more about his role during World War I and World War II, and why this was such a, you know, monumental period of time, you know, not only in Europe but really for the entire Western world. And then in the second segment, we'll also talk about some current events, you know, what's going on with the presidential election and Donald Trump. So we'll have lots to talk about in the second segment. So if you want to hang tight, we'll be right back in just a second. And I would just encourage our listeners to consider subscribing to access the second subscribers only segment. And Mike, hang tight. We will be right back.
Are you tired of being lied to? Are you sick of the cultural Marxist anti-white propaganda poisoning the minds and souls of our children, friends, and family? Are you looking for honest, objective political and historical analysis? Check out therealistreport.com and subscribe today. Help us compete with and ultimately replace the mainstream mass media. We have the ability, the dedication, and the courage to stand up for the truth and for our children's future. Your subscription will grant you access to exclusive members-only content, which consists of hard-hitting and truly unique political and historical commentary from a pro-white perspective. Visit therealistreport.com for more details.